Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. Last week's show we spoke all about the importance of garden wildlife, and on this week's episode we're talking about the practical ways to help. Joined by wildlife presenter from BBC's Spring Watch, Autumn Watch and Country File, Kate McRae, or as she's commonly known as Wildlife Kate, we spoke about the projects and challenges she's been setting up for people during lockdown that are easy, accessible and cheap for everyone to get involved with. We also spoke about her work on TV and in schools. Kate has a natural way of inspiring people, especially the youth, in nature, and it's so clear to see how she has developed a large following online purely based on her motivation to be around wildlife. At the end of the show, I'll share Kate's website and socials with you, where you can find the information on the challenges that many people, including myself, are currently working on. Thanks so much again for tuning in and enjoy the show. Hi Kate, how are you? Thank you so much for joining me on today's show. How have you been? How's your day been? Have you enjoyed the sun?
I have enjoyed the sun a lot, actually. This great weather makes lockdown a lot easier, especially when you've got a big garden to manage.
Yeah, we're going to come on to that in a minute. But yeah, absolutely. It's I keep thinking throughout this lockdown, if the weather wasn't like this, what would I be doing? Because I really, inside the house does not suit well for me.
No, I am pretty much out in whatever the weather, but it does make it a lot easier when it's glorious like this.
Yeah, absolutely. For my listeners, I'm well aware, but for my listeners, a few people may not be. Could you just explain who you are and what you do for us?
Okay, well, my name is Kate McRae, but I'm more commonly known as Wildlife Kate now, mainly because just about everything I do now, work-wise and leisure-wise, is wildlife-based. So I do a range of wildlife-based sort of consultancy to do with anything from developing school grounds or gardens and camera installation and filming and monitoring wildlife, because I am a teacher as well. So I still teach 2 days a week, teaching outdoor learning in a big junior school in Nuneaton. And then most of my work stems around my own garden, which is a good sized garden, but not enormous, on the outskirts of Lichfield. And my sort of work developed from my love and passion of nature. And I started to blog about the kind of thing I did, I don't know, probably 10, 12, 15 years ago now.
Oh, wow.
And and then people sort of jumped on board. And the more I did and the more projects I did showing how people can connect and engage with wildlife in their gardens, the more interest there was. And then I started doing a filming with sort of commonly available kit. And it sort of exploded from there, and then got picked up by Spring Watch, and obviously doing stuff for them then gives you a bit of a boost career-wise.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I still do quite a bit of bits and pieces for them. Mainly, I think, because I'm garden-based. You know, there's nothing I do here that anyone couldn't do. I'm self-taught. I've just got an enthusiasm and a passion for what I do, and that comes across, hopefully, in all my work.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's an interesting point that you just said there as well. You have that passion and enthusiasm. So I guess, like, how and when did that thirst for nature and wildlife and that passion, how did that begin for you? When did that start?
Oh, for as long as I can remember. I mean, I grew up in southeast London, so it wasn't as if I grew up in the wilds. But I've been told that from when I was tiny, I was always interested. And certainly we had a nice garden, and I always fed the birds. And my passion started with birds, because we had a bird table. And I've always been a diary writer from when I was a child, and I think that's what, you know, obviously developed into my blog, because I like recording things.
Yeah.
And when I look back at my diary from about age 7 till right through uni, my diary is just all about birding and what I've seen and what I've taken photographs of. And so it is quite funny looking back, because it's always been something that's interested me, and it's always been something I've loved.
Yeah, and that's nice that you said about south
South London as well, because I'm here in North London, and it's very true that you don't need to be out in the sticks. You don't need to be out in the countryside to be able to see wildlife. It's all about how and where you look, really, and how you invite it in, I guess.
Yeah, and I think because my interest started just in my own garden, that's really is what stayed with me, because to me the most important thing is to get people to connect and to engage with what's right on their doorstep. Mm. and that extends right into education as well. I do a lot of work with kids, and I'm passionate about getting kids enthused and excited about natural history. And in the curriculum we teach them about rainforests and far-flung places, but I think until they understand and appreciate what's right on their doorstep and what they can do to help and support and protect that, then it's difficult to get across to them how important it is in the wider picture, because you've got to instill that love and that passion. And it's so easy to do with young children. Yeah. You know, they've got an innate love of wildlife.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't take much to fire that up.
Absolutely. And I think that's a wonderful point you touched on there, and it's something I've said in some of my live shows before, is that when we talk about the environment or nature, it's so easy to picture these faraway places that, you know, like you said, the rainforest or the Antarctic or Africa, but really it's bringing it closer to home. It's really saying, look, everywhere you walk is the environment. It's not, because the rainforest isn't burning down, it's burning down, doesn't mean that your native environment as well is not being damaged and stuff and needs looking after. I think that's a very important point to kind of hold in.
Yeah, and I think, one of the positives that's come out of this awful situation is that people have really come to appreciate what space they've got. Mm. Because so many people have contacted me and said, you know, we've always had the garden, but we've never really shown much interest in it. And then suddenly, when that was the only space I had, suddenly I've started to realise how important it is for me. And you know, a lot of what I do is about getting people to engage, and my website I built for this period, I've done a lot of activities on there, and so many people have engaged and done them, and it just, you know, it's a lot of work to get stuff like that filmed and online. Yeah. But I've only got to get one person sending me a picture of them and their kids building a water hole for birds, and it's like, oh my god, that was all worth it. I'm just happy that one person's done it. But invariably it's a lot more than one.
Yeah, well, this is what I'm so glad you've touched on that point as well, because I was looking through your website and I couldn't believe the amount of challenges that you've set people is wonderful, and just ideas as I was looking through, I was like, I've never even thought of doing it in that way. And one of my favorite challenges, like you said, is the one that I see a lot on Twitter as well, which is the waterhole challenge. Can you explain to the listeners what that is?
I'm a pretty creative person, and I love doing things that sort of easy to do enough that I want people to see what I do and feel suitably inspired that they think, oh my god, I could do that. And invariably they want to go and do that. So initially I started doing the challenges with the view that they were for the 550 children that are homeschooling from the school I teach at, because I do all the outdoor learning and obviously they all love it. So I thought, it'd be really cool while they're at home to start doing some challenges that they could have a go and that I would deliver them via a video, because for kids particularly, it's really hard when they're just at home and they've got like a printout sent from school. I mean, my school have been brilliant and they ring up and they do, you know, Zoom meetings, and I know lots of and team meetings, lots of schools are doing that. But for kids, they need that face-to-face. So I started sort of videoing so that they could see me and I could say hi and I could say, you know, what this is what we're going to have a go at today. And I started doing the first two, and then a couple of friends, when I was telling them, were like, oh, well, can we access these? We'd love to do them with our kids. And I was thinking, well, wait a minute, it's silly just to limit it to the school. So I built a whole sort of new website with this period in mind, really, so that I could focus on the activities, I could focus on the cameras I'm live streaming, and give people a chance to really home in on gardens and what you can do in even a small space. I know I'm really privileged here. I've got a lovely space and it's right on the edge of the countryside. But, you know, people are doing these projects in their own tiny gardens. And the water hole was really, if you can add one thing to your garden for wildlife, then water is a good place to start. But most people, you know, the thought of digging a pond, although a lot of ponds have been dug this season. yeah. I wanted to do something that children could do and families could do without it being too much of a major upheaval. Mm. And the last few years, probably over the last 6 or 7 years, my most successful water spaces have been using recycled tyres. So it's, and they're, I mean, in normal times, but even now people have managed to get hold of them.
Yeah.
You know, a garage or a tyre place actually pay to get rid of them.
Oh, wow.
So they're more than happy to give you as literally as many as you can get in the back of the car. So, and actually farmers, I got my recent one to film the challenge from a local farmer because they put them on top of the silage bale. So he said, oh yeah, I've got hundreds, you can have one. and it's basically a really simple way. You haven't got to dig it in. You use the tyre, you line the tyre, and then you fill it with soil, and then put a waterproof membrane over the top and bank up the soil either side so it's almost like a little volcano. Mm. And then you plant all around the edge and you put rocks and plants and until you would never know it's a tyre.
Yeah.
And so I sort of put out instructions on how to do it. I did a video. I built another one. I've already got four in my garden. So
oh,
my
wow, neighbour over four. The
yeah, my neighbour over the back fence. She's got a lovely garden as well. And so I said to her, "Would you like me to build you one so I can film myself doing it? Because I really don't need any more here." So my neighbour ended up getting one. She was delighted. And I built one in her garden so that I could film myself doing it because I wanted to show how easy and quick it was. And
yeah.
I literally built that in an hour and a half. And within, she said, because she works in her garden room, she said within about an hour and a half, something came down to have a drink.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
Yeah. And I've got mine live streaming on my website at the moment. And it's so busy because obviously it's been really dry as well.
Mm.
It's such an easy thing to do, and you can vary. You can either do it quite shallow, so mine's quite shallow so the birds just come and bathe in it, or I've got a couple that are a little bit deeper and I've even had frogs in those.
Wow, that's amazing. And like you said, it's such an easy and accessible thing for everyone to do, even in a patio garden.
You don't need anything really. I mean, people have used anything from an old bit of tarpaulin to even bin bags as the waterproof material. I mean, I had some offcuts from a pond liner, but you can use anything that's waterproof, a tyre, a bit of soil. I tend to dig up things from all over the garden and plant on in and around it. So it wouldn't actually cost you anything. And all my projects I try to do with what I think people might already have, but yeah. I've always done that. That isn't just something I've done for this period, it's something I always try and do.
Yeah, and I think it makes it so much more accessible for everyone, and in this current time of us really focusing on reduce and reuse and stuff, I think that is really the way forward with, because like I said, I've got a little patio garden here, and even I'm starting to plan to make my little water hole in my garden, because it's possible.
You can just build them on a hard surface, and then just, you know, even if you just banked up soil around the edge, you can actually place it on a hard surface, or just put pots around it. Or I've even used an old Hessian sack to cover the tyre before when I built one on like a patio so you couldn't see the tyre, and then packed soil in. And before long, it had all sort of degraded the Hessian and all things started to growing the edges. So,
amazing.
You know, it's really possible, and it's so quickly used.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
That's wonderful.
Very rewarding.
You said, yeah, definitely rewarding. Like you said, especially with the dry weather at the moment, I can imagine there's animals loving this, that people are doing this in their garden.
Absolutely.
You said at the beginning you've done some work as part of BBC's Spring Watch and Autumn Watch, and also on Country Fire. What kind of things were you doing for these shows?
Some of it's linked in with the camera work I do. So I've got, my garden is wired literally all over the place, and I have anything up to 20 cameras here on nests, in nest boxes, like on the water hole, in a field next to me, in a mammal box. So I've got cameras everywhere, and then those all wire back to a central computer system where all the cameras are monitored. and record. So I lift the footage off and then I blog about that and I write about it. So I also manage a 7-acre site in Morven. It's a private garden. In fact, they saw me on Springwatch and contacted me because they wanted to put some cameras in because it's such a lovely location. And that was, I don't know, 7 years ago, and now I still go. So I now have installed, we've installed, well, between 20 and 30 cameras at certain times there. I've built a badger set with cameras inside. Last summer I built an otter holt.
Oh, amazing.
And the site is amazing. It goes down onto the River Severn, and it's absolutely beautiful. I'm really missing not going there at the moment.
Yeah, I
I'm
bet.
I'm hoping that by the end of the summer I'll... we'll be able to get back there. So so sometimes it's the footage I've captured, sometimes it's the story of how I've done those, so the vision I've had and how I've then carried that out. So I've filmed with them on site. So Springwatch have been here and filmed in my garden. Countryfile came to UView and filmed there. And then I do talks. I did Countryfile Live last year and did on the stage with Ellie Harrison and sort of talked about the kind of work I do and how accessible it is now. Because the kit is, you know, the technology and the kit now, what we can do now, even 10 years ago, we would have only dreamt of and only the professionals would have done. But I don't class myself as a professional. I'm a very keen naturalist. And and I'm basically applying all the technology. Sometimes it's not actually designed to do, but reapplying that and playing around with it and enabling me to monitor and film wildlife.
That's amazing. It's such a wonderful thing to be able to capture it when you're not there as well, because you see it from such a different point of view, don't you?
Oh, yeah, and it's become such an integral part of my life. You know, in my office when I'm working, I've got two screens and they show all my cameras, and I'm so used to being able to see all parts of my garden and what's going on. So I know, you know, even without looking at the cameras, I know what species are likely to have been there, when they will have been there, how they will be behaving. And I sort of forget how much I know because it's such an integral part of my life now.
It's
sort of turned into an obsession, really. I spend an awful lot of time. You can imagine when you've got lots of cameras all recording all the time, you tend to spend a lot of time also looking back at all that footage.
Yeah. Essentially, you've become wildlife big brother, haven't you, really?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it is. But it means that I'm very connected with what's in my own space.
Yes.
And I know what's going on, and I know the impact my work in my garden has done. You know, when I bought the house 23 years ago, it was nothing like it is now. And when I look at the amount of wildlife I get here now, it's a product of me creating the habitats. You know, all my gardening, I don't use any chemicals, I use nothing artificial. So there's lots going on.
Do you have a favourite season at all for your garden or for the sites that you manage?
I don't really. I love it all.
Yeah.
I mean, I love spring in the fact that I've got Nestbox camera kits and, you know, so I'm watching nesting. So that's always an exciting time of the year. But there's all, I love the autumn and winter when the bird tables become really busy. So I sort of love all elements. Probably the quietest time wildlife wise is actually in the middle of the summer.
Yes. Yeah,
because once I'm over all the nesting period and there's plenty of natural food, then obviously they're not so pulled into my garden. So that's when I tend to concentrate on projects ready for the next season. So by the end of the summer, I'm already thinking about next season and the boxes I'm going to put up and the camera system, because it takes a lot of planning. You're not sort of thinking a week before,
absolutely.
Oh, they're going to be, you know, I better get that sorted out. You know, it can take months of planning and getting the cameras right in the boxes before they go up, because once they're up and the birds are in, you can't be going in and fiddling.
Yeah.
And of course tech changes all the time and I'm always striving. I'm never satisfied with what I've produced, so whereas things might work really well 1 year, then a new camera comes out and I'm thinking, oh, that's a bit of a game changer.
Is this where we creep into the obsession part?
Do some more consultancy work to earn enough to get that next camera in. So, the technology's moving on all the time and it gives you so much more scope. You know, cameras are getting higher tech and smaller, so you can get, you know, some really high tech stuff inside quite small spaces. And whereas before I'd have to do a lot, all the pre-focusing and that as I set it up, now I can, a lot of the kit I can put in place and then go back to my computer and focus it and zoom in from my PC. So it's way better and it gives me a lot more flexibility. For example, I've just had a wood pigeon started nesting right outside my bathroom. And whereas before it would have been in the position she's in the hedge, it would have been really hard to get the focus right on the camera and then get the camera in place without disturbing her because she was already on the nest.
Yeah.
But with the technology now, when she was off the nest, I literally just put the camera up on the top of the hedge, checked on my phone because I can see if it's looking in the right direction. And then I was able to get back down the ladder, go up into the into my office. And by the time I got into the office, she was back on the nest and I was able to zoom the camera in and focus it remotely.
Oh, wonderful.
So it took all of probably 20 seconds to put the camera in place. Yeah. I wouldn't have been able to do that even a couple of years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just all moving so fast in a positive way with stuff like this,
yeah,
isn't it?
And becoming more affordable. So
yeah, we go back to that point of being accessible as well. It's not, like you said, you don't have to be the top pro BBC wildlife filmmaker to be able to get the new camera. You can actually, you know, you can do some stuff on your phone even now. So.
Oh, I do. I mean, I'm Twitter is my big platform. I've got, well, a lot more followers now, probably about 24,000, I think. And most of what I put on Twitter is with my phone.
Yeah.
You know, I video stuff, I take photos of just really, it's all about, to me, it's about awe and wonder. And I know that sounds a bit airy-fairy, but, everywhere I go, I'm looking for things. I'm looking for shapes or, as a photographer as well, but not a professional photographer, just a love of natural form. And I think this me posting a constantly, particularly I tend to walk very early in the morning, either run or walk. I've got a dog I take out and I've got a really nice route I do straight from the house, and I just post photos every morning, anywhere between 5 and I don't know, about 10-15 images sometimes, of just little things like buttercups with the sun behind them, because I've been walking the same route, although I've walked this route for 20 years, I've not walked it quite as much as I have this time. You know, I've noticed the changes in the hedgerow, how the fauna and flora have changed. I've been using some really cool little apps for ID, because I'm not particularly good on plants. So I've been using that time to ID the stuff I'm seeing regularly. So I'm actually improving, you know, my ID skills. And I don't, you know, I'm more than happy to say what I don't know on Twitter as much as what I do know, because I'm just an ordinary person with a keen enthusiasm for natural history. But if what you don't know, you can find out, you know, and apps now, oh, you've got everything at the just on your phone.
Yeah.
You can just point, like the iNaturalist, the free app. I use the iNaturalist Seek app, and you can just point your phone at a plant or a leaf, and it just tells you what it is. And then you can log it as your location, so you keep a record of everything. And then when I do that same walk again, I can think, oh, that's the one I photographed yesterday. And then I can mentally think, now, what was that? If I can't remember, I can just go back into the app and think, oh, yeah. And then the next day, I can think, oh, I know what that is now.
Yeah,
and then you're learning, and it's a great thing to do with kids as well.
Yeah,
because they're
absolutely
using the tech they love, and they're learning as well. And it once you start IDing stuff, you're looking out for it. Then you're thinking, oh yeah, that's that one. Or you're in another location, you think, oh, I've seen that one before.
Yeah,
and then before you know it, you're really looking. And I think that's the skill that a lot of people have lost.
Yes,
they've lost that skill of looking and seeing and hearing. People go out, they put their headphones on, they look at their phone, and I'm like, no, when you're out, yeah, you can use your phone on your app, but don't put your headphones in, listen to nature.
Yeah, listen, yeah.
You know, look around and
know, yeah, and I'll say that now.
Makes you feel good.
I'll say that now. Anyone listening to the podcast, if you're out for a walk now, stop. Take your headphones out. Listen to this show when you get home.
Yeah, exactly. Listen to it when it's raining or you can't get out. Or it's the evening. When the weather's like this, I find it really hard to do any work inside.
Oh God, so do I. So do I.
I just want to be outside.
God, yeah. I mean, I can't. I just need to be out all the time, and like you said, looking. And I think it's the other thing with, like you said, the identifying plants and things like that. I think gone are the days where we can say I don't know and it that be the end of it, because it's kind of not an excuse. It's fine not to know, but like you said, we've got so much accessibility at the palm of our hands, and it is a privilege to have that, but we can
and you haven't
learn.
Got to, you know, you haven't got to be able to ID it to love it or to appreciate it, but I actually like knowing what it is.
Yes.
And maybe that's just me, but I do like if I've seen a new plant growing, like there was a, I knew it was a vetch of some sort, just suddenly started flowering in the hedge.
Yeah.
But I wanted to know what it was. And I don't know why, because it doesn't make me appreciate it or think it's any more beautiful by IDing it. But that's just me. I just like to know what they are. I like to think that if I saw it again, I'd think, oh, yeah, that's the bush vetch. I remember seeing that.
Yeah, and there's something lovely about being able to walk around and identify things, because people do, yeah, especially with wildflower and stuff. It's, there is that nice thing of saying, oh, that's... I mean, now my mind's gone blank and I can't think of one, but that's that's that, for example, and it's just nice to be able to do that.
And birds as well. I mean, for me, a lot of the work I do initially with kids is because it's so easy to get a bird feeder out or get a little bird bath or something similar.
Yeah.
And I found when I did a lot of work with children and little challenges about learning to ID common British birds, once they could identify them and they loved the challenge of learning them and who could learn the most, and once they could actually ID them, they suddenly started seeing them. So there were kids running to school saying, I just saw a nuthatch, and it like warmed my heart, you know.
Oh, that's amazing.
Those nuthatches had always been there, but now they'd learnt to ID them, they were looking out for them, and the more I taught them, the more they wanted to know. And you think, you know, if you can instill that interest and love when they're at primary age, even if they lose it at secondary, they'll come back to it. And it's amazing what they learn at that point. A lot of the time, they never lose. I mean, there were some kids, I did it at Michael Drayton Jr., where I teach, many years ago, probably about 6 or 7 years ago. And not long ago, I saw a child who'd left, you know, who was like sort of mid-teenage by now.
Mm.
And they said, I can still remember all those birds. And this was like, you know, not this, this was probably a child who would never have normally got interested in birds.
Yeah.
It was just that those formative years are just such a wonderful time if you can capture it.
Yeah.
And all children that I work with at Michael Drayton just love coming out. They love doing it. And I'm, you know, I'm really hoping that schools really build on that.
Yeah.
You know, the curriculum's really packed and it is hard, but there's so many ways you can take the curriculum outside, and we're lucky because I've developed big areas at school, so we do that a lot more than an average school. But you have to have someone there who's passionate and who drives that. And I'm in a very privileged position as a you know, top of the scale primary school teacher, where that is my role. I don't have a class. Yeah. I just do outdoor learning.
That's amazing. What a wonderful job.
Yeah, and I wish there was funding there for someone like me in every school. Yeah. We're just lucky because we're such a big school. And I do a lot in the pastoral care team as well. So my wage is paid through that. But it's, you know, the benefits are so far reaching in mental health and in so many ways outside of, you know, sort of academia, as we say.
Yeah.
And I think people have come to realise more than ever in this time how important being outside and being in touch with nature is for our mental health.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Especially, like you said, in these trying times, I think that's something that I think a lot of people are going to carry away with them after.
Yeah, I really do hope so. I mean, it's something that's been you know, is part of my absolute essence and being. So I've always banged on about it.
Yeah.
But I think possibly people have like saying, oh, now I know what Kate's been going on all these years. You know, even close friends who are like, oh, she's always been like this, even when we were at uni.
Yeah.
They're like going, oh, actually, you know, I get it now.
Yeah, yeah, it's easy to understand once it gets taken away, isn't it?
Yeah, well, this is it. And I think once you get it under your skin, then you're really hooked.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. My last question to you, Kate, is, and this is probably something you, without thinking, pass on to people anyway in your job. But if you could pass on one bit of advice to, I always say the generation of today, but I do mean just people in general, in regards to the natural world. What kind of advice would you pass on to people?
It would be learn to love the space that you live in. Actually look outside at, you know, however small your space. It could be a windowsill, it could be a window box, it could be a tiny patio. You know, even people who live in flats often have got maybe a little windowsill, or you could have a stick on your window bird feeder.
Yeah.
Or you could look out with binoculars and see something, you know, or a local green space. Just
yeah.
Learn to love that space and find out what's living there, and learn to look. So look for things that are beautiful. Smell a flower, listen to the bird song, touch the leaves. I know it does sound a little bit airy fairy, but it really does make a difference.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
It, you know, the science proves it, how it improves, lowers stress levels, and it really does. I just can't imagine what I'd be like if I was denied access to the outdoors. Because I just love it all, and wherever I am, I seek that, and I look for the beauty in nature, and just the amount of comments and followers I've had. And I'm not posting, you know, award-winning images. I'm posting everyday images of the sun shining through a leaf, or capturing the colour on a buttercup, or the beautiful structure of the hogweed that are just starting to come out now. You know, everyday stuff. And sometimes people go, oh, I've never really looked at that, or I've never really thought about it like that.
Yeah.
So it's making people stop and look, I think. But learn to love the space you're in. Because once you do that, then you're going to start to care and get connected with it. And once you're connected and you start to care, then that's good news for the rest of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what it comes down to. Learn to love the space and protect it.
Yeah, well, that's it. And then that has knock-on effects for the bigger picture.
Absolutely. Kate, thank you so much for joining me on this episode. It's been a pleasure to chat to you. And I wish you all the best for the rest of the coming weeks.
Yeah, and get making that water hole in your garden.
I am. I cannot wait to get a picture of it. That's what I'm most excited
about. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm going to hold you to that.
No, yeah, please do. Please do. Take care.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks again for tuning in to Into the Wild. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and shows that Kate is currently working on, you can do so on Twitter and Instagram at Kate McRae. You can also check out the garden challenges on her website, www.wildlifekate/alfrescowild.co.uk. And as always, don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and Podbean, and you can also get in touch with us on social media at Into the Wild Pod. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.